It is a privilege to be here, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. You know, I'm just aware that as I say that, I'm always thinking of Bodhidharma, for some reason, sitting facing a wall for 9 years. I always think of Bodhidharma when I say the invocation. Today, I'd like to open the talk on right mindfulness with a passage from an article by, it's called Remembering Reality, by a Zen Buddhist priest, Hoko Carnegis. And much of what I say today will be informed by her understanding. So this is her passage. One can hardly pick up a magazine or read a blog today without encountering somebody's view on mindfulness. It's become the darling of self-help programs, corporate coaches, and therapists. Advocates hasten to assure us that while mindfulness has its roots in Buddhism, these can be ignored in the interest of making it available to the widest possible audience. One need not maintain a connection to the religious tradition from which mindfulness comes, they say, in order to experience its benefits, remaining calm under stress, improved relationships, and healing the wounds of the past. However, all this is not what Buddhist mindfulness has traditionally been about. Mindfulness has undergone a long and winding journey since the time of Shakyamuni, when it was aimed at freeing one from the grip of craving and aversion. That expression, craving and aversion, means likes and dislikes. And then from then to the time of Dogen, when it became a meaning of experiencing the one reality, to the modern West, where it's become a popular self-help technique. How did we get here? What do we lose when we take mindfulness out of context? What is the role of mindfulness in Soto Zen, and how can we effectively practice it in our daily lives? Mindfulness, by the way, was the Buddha's very first teaching. We talk officially about his first teaching being to the five friends of his that practiced serious asceticism. But actually, even before he left the forest where he sat under the Bo tree and attained enlightenment, even before then, he taught mindfulness to the children of the forest. And I'm going to read you Thich Nhat Hanh's version of this delightful scene. So when Sujata was a little girl who discovered Siddhartha before he was the Buddha, Siddhartha, he didn't have enough energy. He was bathing in the river and he didn't have enough energy to get himself out of the river. So she sort of found himself collapsed on the bank. So when Sujata brought Siddhartha's food the noon following his enlightenment, when he finished eating, he asked Sujata to return home. He said he wanted to meet the village children that afternoon in the forest. So this is Thich Nhat Hanh. Many children came, including Svasti's brothers and sisters. The boys all had bathed and put on clean clothes. The girls wore their loveliest saris. Sujata's sari was covered, it was ivory colored. Nandabala wore a sari the color of banana shoots, and Bhima's sari was pink. The children, looking as fresh and colorful as flowers, sat around Siddhartha beneath the papala tree. Sujata brought a basket full of coconuts and chunks of palm sugar as a special treat. The children scooped out the tasty coconut meat and ate it with the delicious sugar. Nandabala and Subhash brought a basket full of tangerines. Siddhartha sat with the children, his happiness complete. Rupak offered him a chunk of coconut with a piece of palm sugar on a papala leaf. Nandabala offered him a tangerine. Siddhartha accepted their offerings and ate with the children. They were still enjoying their lunch when Sujata made an announcement. "Dear friends, today is the happiest day our teacher has ever known. He has discovered the great way. I feel this is also a very important day for me. Brothers and sisters, let us consider this a day of great jubilation for all of us. We are here today to celebrate the enlightenment of our teacher. Respected teacher, the great path has been found. We know you cannot stay with us forever. Please teach us the things you think we might be able to understand." And this was an age, by the way, where there was a lot of spiritual seeking. And so even Sujata would have heard about all these seekers who, you know, meditate in the forests and are trying to attain enlightenment. This was known. So that's why even a little girl would say such a thing. Sujata joined her palms together and bowed to Gautama to express her respect and devotion. Nandabala and the other children also joined their palms and bowed with deepest sincerity. Siddhartha quietly gestured for the children to sit back, and he said, "You are all intelligent children, and I am sure you will be able to understand and practice the things I will share with you. The great path I have discovered is deep and subtle, but anyone willing to apply his or her heart and mind can understand and follow it." And so you get how the Buddha, I'm always saying, how he taught to the person that he was speaking to. This is an example of that. This is a really good example of the Buddha teaching to the people that he's talking to. And he makes his, he makes what he says understandable to them. So when you children peel a tangerine, you can eat it with awareness or without awareness. What does it mean to eat a tangerine in awareness? When you are eating the tangerine, you are aware that you are eating the tangerine. You fully experience its lovely fragrance and sweet taste. When you peel the tangerine, you know that you are peeling the tangerine. When you remove a slice and put it in your mouth, you know that you are removing a slice and putting it in your mouth. When you experience the lovely fragrance and sweet taste of the tangerine, you are aware that you are experiencing the lovely fragrance and sweet taste of the tangerine. The tangerine Nandabala offered me had 9 sections. I ate each morsel in awareness and saw how precious and wonderful it was. I did not forget the tangerine, and thus the tangerine became something very real to me. If the tangerine is real, The person eating it is real. That is what is meant, to eat a tangerine in awareness. I love that line. If the tangerine is real, the person eating it is real. That is what it means to eat a tangerine in awareness. Children, what does it mean to eat a tangerine without awareness? When you are eating the tangerine, you do not know that you are eating the tangerine. You do not experience the lovely fragrance and sweet taste of the tangerine. When you peel the tangerine, you do not know that you are peeling the tangerine. When you remove a slice and put it in your mouth, you do not know that you're removing the slice and putting it in your mouth. When you smell the fragrance or taste the tangerine, you do not know that you are smelling the fragrance and tasting the tangerine. Eating a tangerine in such a way, you cannot appreciate its precious and wonderful nature. If you are not aware that you are eating the tangerine is not real. If the tangerine is not real, the person eating it is not real either. Children, that is eating a tangerine without awareness. Children, eating the tangerine in mindfulness means that while eating the tangerine, you are truly in touch with it. Your mind is not chasing after thoughts of yesterday or tomorrow, as we all know, but is dwelling fully in the present moment. The tangerine is truly present. Living in mindful awareness means to live in the present moment. Your body and mind are dwelling in the very here and now. A person who practices mindfulness can see things in the tangerine that others are unable to see. An aware person can see the tangerine tree, the tangerine blossom in the spring, the sunlight and rain which nourished the tangerine. Looking deeply, one can see 10,000 things which have made the tangerine possible. Looking at a tangerine, a person who practices awareness can see all the wonders of the universe and how all things interact with one another. Children, our daily life is just like a tangerine. Just as the tangerine is composed of sections, each day is comprised of 24 hours. 1 hour is like one section of tangerine. Living all 24 hours of a day is like eating all sections of the tangerine. The path I have found is the path of living each hour of the day in awareness, mind and body always dwelling in the present moment. The opposite is to live in forgetfulness. If we live in forgetfulness, we do not know that we are alive. We do not fully experience life, because our mind and body are not dwelling in the here and now. So this is the teaching of mindfulness that the Buddha gave to the children. This was his very first teaching, mindfulness. Later, when the Buddha taught right mindfulness to the monks, the talk was called The Four Foundations of Mindfulness, and it's recorded in the Satipatthana Sutra. A sutra is just a recorded talk of the Buddha. And so these are the four sentences of importance in this talk that he gave called The Four Foundations of Mindfulness. So our Buddha Shakyamuni said to his disciples, there are four foundations of mindfulness on which people should depend. These four foundations of mindfulness refer to contemplating the body as impure, contemplating sensation as suffering, contemplating mind as impermanent, and contemplating phenomena as non-substantial. So basically, these teachings were designed to disenchant early Buddhist practitioners with the phenomenal world and help them loosen their grip of craving and aversion, likes and dislikes. Dogen, who deals with ultimate truths, reinvented these four foundations of mindfulness. So Dogen always, he always sounds very extreme, but we don't really understand ultimate truths. They're not understandable with the intellect. And so they sound far out, but actually they're reality itself. So Dogen says, I, Ehe, also have four foundations of mindfulness, contemplating the body as a skin bag, contemplating sensation as eating bowls, contemplating mind as fences, walls, tiles, and pebbles, and contemplating phenomena as old man Zhang drinking wine and old man Li getting drunk. So one drinks wine and the other gets drunk. Dogen's view is based on the non-duality of subject and object. Thus, there is nothing of which one is mindful and no one maintaining something called mindfulness. While he doesn't take issue with the Buddha regarding the early teachings about mindfulness, Dogen goes beyond the usual conclusions about these elements to see the phenomenal world simply as it is. In other words, he teaches ultimate truths instead of conventional truths. And for those of you who don't know the difference between ultimate truths and conventional truths, these are called the two truths in Buddhism, and I gave a talk on them, I think in the second series, and you can go back and click on that talk and listen to the difference between ultimate truths and conventional truths. And what I read you about what the Buddha taught to the children in the forest, those were conventional truths. All right. And then, so Dogen teaches ultimate truths. And while his teaching, like the Buddha's, aims to help us loosen the grip of craving and aversion, it's designed not to discourage us from engagement with the world, but actually to allow us further immersion in the world and understand that all things are interconnected. The Buddha mentioned this actually, but he didn't make it into a main point. So Dogen's foundations for mindfulness are very much about being in the world and maintaining awareness of the interconnection of all beings in the middle of daily life. So they're about remembering reality, remembering that everything is interconnected. The rise of Mahayana Buddhism in the beginning of the Common Era shifted the focus of Buddhist practice and introduced the Bodhisattva ideal. And so the teachings evolved from an emphasis on no self to a teaching that we are in reality the great cosmic self. So when there's non-duality and all things are connected, then actually we are Buddha. There's no separation. So the Buddha becomes a transcendent being with whom we are already identical. In this context, mindfulness is less about focusing on any one element to realize it's unsaid, you know, it's the craving and aversion around it, and more about cultivating the naturally arising awareness of the interdynamic functioning of the systems of the universe. So the naturally arising awareness that all things are interconnected, all things in the vast extreme of the universe and cosmos. Even Zazen done in such a way to try to block out noise and other distractions is not a manifestation of mindfulness. That's not what we're about. Any activity undertaken as a mindfulness practice is a gateway through which we enter so completely that there's no separation between ourselves and the activity, and no separation between ourselves, the activity, and everything else around us. When we stop directing and focusing our attention, attention arises of itself and excludes nothing. So basically, we need to let ourselves alone. We need to stop directing and focusing our attention and allowing our natural attention to arise. This is the self that has no beginning and no end. If mind is everything we encounter, then right mindfulness is understanding there's no gap between ourselves and the rest of this one unified reality that transcends time and space. This refers to a school in Buddhism called the mind-only school, and it says that literally everything we encounter is mind. Literally everything we encounter is mind. And mind, like everything else, is impermanent. So everything we encounter is impermanent also. So here are Dogen's four foundations as we experience them in daily life. So contemplating the body as a skin bag. So in contrast with Shakyamuni's instruction to contemplate the body as impure, Dogen tells us to see the body simply for the skin bag that it is, without judging it to be impure or pure, whatever. So he doesn't, there's no distinction with Dogen, who is teaching ultimate reality, between pure and impure. We don't make those distinctions. Dogen sees the body as the ground of awakening and thus indispensable. Without the body, there would be no practice, no preaching, no mindfulness. The body is necessary for the kind of mindful and completely wholehearted daily activity. That's our true nature. When we act selflessly with no gap, with no subject and object, that is the complete manifestation of Buddha. In that instance, trying to engage in anything additional is pointless. So it would be an attempt to add an extra element to the reality of the body as the entire universe in the 10 directions. Mindfulness of the body, Dogen says, is the body's own mindfulness practice. There can be no separation between the body and mind, the body and universe, our practice and awakening. You have to understand that, just listen to these teachings and hold them dearly. Ultimate truth is beyond the understanding of the intellect. which is why in Buddhism, we try to just pay attention to the present moment and not get carried away. Because the more grounded we can be in the present reality, the more likely we will be able to touch the ultimate truth. So that's what he says about contemplating the body as a skin bag, which it is. It's just a piece of fascia that holds all of our organs and bones. People who do dissection in anatomy, they say this all the time. So contemplating sensation as eating bowls, Dogen says, a monk's mouth is like an oven. Just as an oven does not resist or complain whether we put in cake, potatoes, or dog biscuits, a monk accepts whatever is put into her bowls. And then in takuhatsu, like with your alms bowl, the monk accepts whatever she receives, and upon receiving it, chants. This is the chant: the virtue of the two kinds of offerings, material and dharma, is boundless. The perfection of generosity is completed and benefits all the beings of the whole Dharma world. So the chant is an offering of Dharma given by the monk who receives an offering of food in his or her eating bowl. So the perfection or paramita of generosity goes full circle. Also, when offerings are prepared and served at mealtime, they're accepted with the recognition that they represent more than food. They represent the larger universe of labor, materials, and energy that are all received with equanimity. If we contemplate sensation as eating bowls, we accept the sensations with which they are presented, just as we accept what's put into our bowls. They are not ours, but neither are they outside, somewhere separate from us. So practicing with a body means practicing with the feeling that arises when the senses come in contact with sense objects. So this is referring to, we have six senses, like, let's say, our ear. And then the ear has a sense object, sound, and then this ear and the sound together have hearing. So this is what is said in Buddhism. There's an ear that comes in contact with sound, and then hearing is the consciousness. And there are six of these consciousnesses, and that's just mechanical. It's just all mechanical. So we don't need to get excited about it. We don't need to have feelings around it. We just need to notice, oh, sound. That's all. We just notice that there's sound, or we notice that there's taste, or we notice that there's smell or an odor. But there doesn't need to be feelings around it. We can simply remain aware of them arising without obsessing or fixating on them, and without analyzing them, to invest them with a special meaning. That's what Dogen means when he says we experience sensations as eating bowls. We just accept whatever's there and just name it, basically. Contemplating mind as fences, walls, tiles, and pebbles. Dogen just says that our challenge is to not forget that everything we encounter is impermanent. And by nature, just as mind is impermanent, And mind is not somewhere else, right here among all the forms that make up our daily existence. Coffee cups, smartphones, and running shoes are all mind, which means they're all impermanent. And contemplating phenomena, as old Meng Zhang drinking wine and old Men Li getting drunk, Dogen is quoting from Yumen's record sayings, but he's using it to show the interconnectedness of all beings. And that's how this interconnectedness is perceived. So one person drinks and the other person gets drunk. That's the interconnectedness. So we ignore the phenomena simply. We can't ignore phenomena. Just because we don't understand that, that doesn't mean we can ignore it. We don't ignore it. We have to go beyond their non-substantiality and bear in mind that they're empty of any self-nature and they're not separate from each other, ourselves, and arising and passing away together in this vast interconnected universe. Everything arises and passes away. Everything is impermanent. That's the basic message of all of this, including our minds, including the Buddha, including everything. So basically, Dogen defines right mindfulness as simply keeping the Dharma and not to lose it. And not losing the Dharma means not losing touch with reality, not forgetting our true nature and the true nature of everything, which is the interconnectedness of all beings. Here is a story from the Buddha's life demonstrating how all this works. And I'm entitling it, Subha Almost Raped. And this is another story from Thich Nhat Hanh's Life of the Buddha. Jivaka's mango grove was tranquil and spacious. Scattered throughout the orchard were small huts for bhikkhunis. One evening, a young bhikkhuni named Subha came to discuss a problem with the Buddha. She had completed her begging and was returning to the mango grove by way of a deserted street, and suddenly a young man appeared and stood in her way. She sensed the dishonorable intentions and began to observe her breath in order to remain calm and clear-headed. She looked directly into his eyes and said, "Sir, I am a nun who follows the way of the Buddha. Please move out of my way so that I may return to my nunnery." The man said, "You are still very young and pretty. Why waste your life by shaving your head and wearing yellow robes? Why live like an ascetic? Listen, miss, your lovely body should be clad in a silk sari from Kasi. Why, I've never seen a woman as pretty as you. Let me show you the pleasures of the body. Come with me." Subha remained calm. "Don't speak foolishly. I seek my happiness in a life of liberation and enlightenment. The five categories of desire only lead to suffering. Allow me to pass. I will be grateful for your understanding." But the man refused. "Your eyes are so beautiful. I've never seen such beautiful eyes. Don't think I'm foolish enough to let you go. You will come with me." He reached out to grab her, but Subha stepped out of reach and said, "Sir, do not touch me. You must not violate a nun. Because I was weary of life, burdened with craving and hatred, I chose the life of spiritual practice. You say my eyes are beautiful? Very well, I will pluck them out and give them to you. Better to be blind than violated by you. Suba's voice was full of determination. The man flinched. He knew she was capable of doing what she said. He stepped back. Suba continued, "Don't let your desires cause you to commit crimes. Don't you know that King Bimbisara has issued a decree that anyone who harms a member of Buddhist Sangha will be dealt with severely? If you do not behave properly, if you threaten my chastity or my life, you will be arrested and punished." Suddenly, the man came to his senses. He saw how blind passion can lead to suffering. He stepped out of the nun's way to let her pass. He called after her, "Please forgive me, sister. I hope you attain your goal on the spiritual path." Suba walked on without looking back. If the Buddha praised the young nun for her courage and clarity, the Buddha praised her. He said, "It is dangerous for nuns to walk alone on deserted paths. That is one of the reasons why I hesitated initially to ordain women. Suba, from now on, no bhikkhuni should travel alone. Whether crossing a river, entering a village to beg, or walking through a forest or a field, no bhikkhuni should walk alone. No bhikkhuni should sleep alone either. Whether she sleeps in a nunnery, a small hut, or beneath a tree, no bhikkhuni should sleep by herself. She should always travel and sleep with at least one other bhikkhuni, so they can watch out for each other and protect each other." The Buddha turned to Ananda and instructed him, "Ananda, please make careful note of this new rule. Request all the bhikkhunis, the bhikkhuni elders, to place this rule in their precepts." So here are some of the most important points that I've made so far today. First, actually three of them are from the Buddha's talk to the children about tangerines. The first one is about eating a tangerine in mindfulness means that while eating the tangerine, you are truly in touch with it. Your mind is not chasing after thoughts of yesterday or tomorrow, but is dwelling fully in the present moment. That's the first most important point made today. Our minds are not chasing after thoughts. They're dwelling in the present moment. And secondly, the Buddha said, if the tangerine is real, the person eating it is real. And third, the Buddha said, an aware person can see the tangerine tree, the tangerine blossom in spring, the sunlight and rain, which nourish the tangerine. Looking deeply, one can see the 10,000 things which have made the tangerine possible. That's the interconnectedness of the whole universe. That's the third most important point made today. And then the fourth were two of Dogen's points. How does it happen when one person drinks sake, another person feels the effects? How can we ignore phenomena simply because they're non-substantial? We can't ignore anything just because they're subtle. We have to go beyond their subtleness and bear in mind both that they are empty of any abiding self nature, including ourselves, and that they are not separate from each other or ourselves, arising and passing away together in the vast interconnected system of causes and conditions. So everything in the there's a vast interconnected system of causes and conditions in the universe, of which we are just swimming in that vast interconnected system. And, you know, we arise and we pass away as everything does. And then the fifth most important point was this point about mindfulness of the body is the body's own mindfulness practice. Mindfulness of the body is the body's own mindfulness practice. There can be no separation between the body and mind. The body and universe are practice and awakening. So when we practice, when we do Zazen, the Soto Zen Buddhist understanding is that that in itself is enlightenment. Practice and enlightenment are the same thing. They happen at the same moment together. There's no separation. And some ideas for reflection during the week. First, when Supa said to the man about to violate her, "You say my eyes are beautiful. Very well, I will pluck them out and give them to you. Better to be blind than violated by you." What did you feel? And do you agree with the Buddhist precaution to have nuns always in twos? Do you agree with that? And what did you feel when she said that? That's the first idea for reflection. And secondly, if you are not aware that you're eating the tangerine, the tangerine is not real. And if the tangerine is not real, the person eating it is not real. And many of us, when we're eating whatever, we are not paying any attention whatsoever. And so experiment with this. Experiment having meals without devices to actually eat and know that you're eating, and eat with your family and know that your family is there and that you're being together with your family. See what happens with that. Third, when your mindfulness is solid, Dogen says, you will not be harmed, even in the midst of the robber of the five senses. This means even when you're filled with desires. So this view is beyond the perceptions and workings of the intellect. But even if you can't fully relate to this view, have you ever experienced mindfulness that's solid? And as a result, you feel stronger, sort of like Subha did. Her mindfulness was absolutely solid, and she knew exactly what she was doing, and she was fully present, and she did exactly the correct thing. When you feel that way, what are times that you have felt that way? And what are the qualities of that experience? To reflect on that, ideally to write about it. Writing is a process of integrating. Fourth, coffee cups, smartphones, and running shoes are all mind, which means they are all impermanent. What does that statement say to you? And lastly, it's not necessary to decide how we feel about feelings. We can simply remain aware of them as they arise without obsessing or fixating on them and without analyzing them to invest them with special meaning. This is one way to practice equanimity. And one identifies the feeling as it arises, names the feeling, and that's all. actually in doing this, because everything changes, the feeling loses its force. If you're angry, you could say anger, name it as anger, and that's all. And in doing that, the anger actually loses its force. And the next time you feel upset, switch gears. Name what's upsetting you, or just that you're upset, name. Losing my equanimity, that's all. And see what happens. I'm wondering if there are questions. I see a question. So today you said mindfulness is about cultivating a naturally arising awareness of the interdynamic functioning of the systems, but how do we cultivate something that's supposed to be naturally arising? That's the question. I really appreciate this question because I think a lot of people have that question. And think of it like a car. So the car gets you from point A to point B, but if you don't maintain it and, give it regular service, eventually it'll stop getting you from point A to point B. And so we support the car, so the car will do its car job. And in the same way, we support our mind so that it can become aware of greater and greater subtleties. Zazen actually is the absolute best practice for this. And a secondary benefit of Zazen is that you don't have to integrate anything. Zazen does Zazen, and when Zazen finishes doing Zazen, it's over. And that's that. Whereas writing about your experience, that's an act of integration. So that you raise your level of consciousness. Being thoughtful also about your behavior helps. And these are ways to cultivate a naturally arising awareness. I see a question. I'm thinking about Old Meng Zong drinking wine and Old Meng Li getting drunk. And the question is, how does it happen when one person drinks sake and another feels the effects? Dogen puts it so graphically because so many of us experience our partner, say, who comes home at 1 from drinking with his buddies, and we feel the effect. So there's Old Meng Zong drinking and Old Man Li feeling the effect. And I know people who continue to do this and will not stop, even though it threatens their marriage, their love relationship. It's not really a question. It's just, this person says, I was struck with how Dogen put it. And he is a terrific poet. But all I can say is that in my 30 plus years of doing couples counseling, I've seen a lot of this situation, and I have never been able to help this situation unless the person who is consistently coming home drunk at one will admit that he or she is an alcoholic and get help for that. Without that, it's as if there's no hope, because, and it's very sad. So unlike old man Lee, the partner suffers terribly. And even if the partner's suffering terribly, the one drinking doesn't stop. And so both of them, and then the other one doesn't leave either. So they both go on suffering terribly, and no one budges. And that's the end of that story. It's not like old man Zahn and old man Lee. That's all.
Gail, excuse me, Gail. A question came in the question box that I'll read here. Often when I'm reading, I find myself just reading words and not totally understanding. I have learned when I read out loud, I'm fully understanding and concentrating on what the author is saying. Is there a way to apply this to becoming more aware and living in the moment?
I do it. Something similar when I'm saying, let's say, a prayer before eating. And often, and I really love this prayer, and I say it before I eat, and I notice almost immediately that my mind's wandering. And I'm not even, I know the prayer really well, and I'm not paying any attention to it. And so I do the same thing. I say it out loud, and suddenly I'm paying attention to it. And so I do the same thing. That's a really good bringing yourself back, so to speak, to your life and the fact that you are alive now, and this is your life now. Let's say saying this prayer is my life now. And I think keep on keeping on. So let's say so with everything, like I use the expression, and I don't know whether this will help you or even mean anything. I use the expression Dharma position. So if I'm slicing a tomato, I will say to myself, I'll see my mind wandering, and I'll say to myself, right now I am in the Dharma position of slicing a tomato. And then I keep slicing and I keep slicing. Right now I'm in the Dharma position of making a salad. And right now I'm in the Dharma position of driving a car. And right now I'm in the Dharma position of giving a Dharma talk. That's, for some reason, that phrase, Dharma position, means a lot to me. And so when I call myself up, right now I'm in the Dharma position of this, I become immediately more patient. And it's helpful, especially with things that I'm impatient around, like traffic. So I'm in traffic, or I'm waiting for the meter to even get into traffic. Right now I'm in the Dharma position of waiting for my turn for the meter to turn green. Right now, I'm in the Dharma position of admiring that dog across the street, you know, something like that. I don't know if this answers your question, but I find this extremely helpful, and it's a kind of comeuppance to remind you, because if we're not alive, the Buddha is correct. We are not alive in those moments. Someone once asked in a yoga class, I think the yoga teacher asked, sort of reprimanding herself, she said to the class, if you get a massage and you're daydreaming, are you really getting the massage? And then everyone just laughed because no, she's not. So that's my answer.
Here's another question, Gail. Could you say a little more about what is meant when Buddhists say everything is mind?
Yeah. That's one of those, it's called the Yogacara school, and they, after, you know, these are people who dedicate their life to Buddhist practice. So these are people who do a lot of zazen and a lot of reading and studying, and they reached the point where they understood that everything is just that nothing exists outside of our mind. So when we see something, it's actually not the thing, it's our mind. It's not the thing, it's our mind. So right now, sitting here and seeing the reflection of what's in the background on my screen, that's just my mind. That's just my mind. But the further school of Buddhism, like Dogen, who he was always dealing with ultimate truths. And again, ultimate truths are not accessible to the workings of our own intellect. We need to go beyond that. We call it enlightenment. Some teachers say enlightenment, whatever that is. So I'm going to say enlightenment, whatever that is. But that's beyond this mind-only school. And it says, well, mind too is impermanent. And everything is impermanent. And everything is just causes and conditions. So even the mind-only school is thrown into this sweep of causes and conditions that constantly change. That's my answer. I'm seeing that we're almost out of time, and I don't think I have time for more questions, but I do want to thank Brian for being here today, and doing not only his own job, but Sahar's, who was not able to be here today, and Brendan, who is always doing so much to help this project. Thank you so much. And I'll see you next week for the final talk in this series. Bye-bye.